I call the meeting of the Higher Education Finance and Policy Division to order. Okay, we are going to wait on doing our minutes in a few minutes and start with our presenters today. I want to welcome Commissioner Dennis Olson, Commissioner of Higher Education, and Meredith Fergus, who knows a lot about the state grant program. And want to welcome you to our committee. So what we're going to do is have you present the updated version of the governor's budget request and just have you introduce yourselves and start.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members. Dennis Olson, Commissioner of the Minnesota Office of Higher Education. Madam Chair, thank you for the opportunity to have the Office of Higher Education back to the committee to provide the committee with a brief overview of the governor's revised budget recommendations for the upcoming biennium. The governor has proposed a total increase for higher education of $164.684 million for the biennium. The governor is requesting an additional $7.147 million over the original budget request recommendation. For the University of Minnesota, $51.034 million increase, which represents a 3.9% increase over the base. That's an additional $11.854 million over the original governor's recommendation. For the Minnesota State College and University System, $64.798 million increase, which represents a 4.5% increase over the base, and that's a total of $13.194 million over the original governor's budget recommendation. For the Office of Higher Education, the request is $48.852 million of increase, which is a 9.5% increase over the base. The governor's budget recommendation addresses affordability through the Minnesota State Grants program. There's a significant investment in the state grant program representing $43.076 million over the biennium. This results in a new calculated average grant increase of $275 for all 80,793 current grant recipients. The new investment will also welcome an additional 2,868 new grant recipients. Pell Grants and the state grants cover 100% of tuition and fees for full-time students from families making up to $45,000 a year who are enrolled at Minnesota State Colleges, two-year colleges, and up to $40,000 a year at Minnesota State Universities, our four-year colleges within the MinState system. There are increased state grants for 500 underserved students that are currently not receiving Pell Grants. Now, the governor's budget also increases chance of success in education and work for lower and middle-income students, and 38% of state grant recipients currently are students of color or indigenous students. There's five main components of the state grant recommendation in the governor's revised budget. Number one is to increase the living and miscellaneous expense allowance, the LME, as well as decrease the assigned family responsibility, or the AFR. There's also a fill-in for unawarded Pell Grants for underserved students. We're also proposing, the governor's proposing, coverage of child care expense as a supplement to the state grant. And finally, a communications campaign focused on affordability and available financial aid, and that would be at the Office of Higher Education. The distribution of state grant by sector is represented in the pie chart on the right side of the slide. For the MinState 2 years, it's $19.930 million, which represents 34% of the recommended increase. Minnesota State 4 years, $11.089 million, representing 19%. At the University of Minnesota, $12.397 million, 21%. For private nonprofit, $13.798 million, 23%. And the for-profit, $2.111 million, representing 3%. Regarding the increase in living and miscellaneous expense allowance, increase to the LME is 100% of poverty to ensure that students have a minimum standard of living and additional resources to pay for necessary books and supplies, while at the same time not having to compromise food and housing expenses. This moves the LME from 101% of poverty, representing a total of 9,422 in fiscal 20, to 108% of poverty, representing $10,117 in fiscal 20. And the fiscal 21 numbers are there, respectively.
Madam Chair and members, for the record, my name is Meredith Burgess. I'm Manager of Financial Aid Research and SLEDS for the Office of Higher Ed. We also, the governor does keep the recommendation to lower the assigned family responsibility. The recommendation is 5 percentage points. As you remember, this helps low-wage working adults and middle-income families receive additional state grant assistance in paying for education. So as you can see in the chart or in the table on the bottom of the slide, it moves the modifiers from 0.84 for dependent students to 0.79, and then comparable 5 percentage point reductions for independent students with and without children. In terms of the other components to the state grant recommendation, the governor's revised proposal keeps the fill-in for unawarded federal Pell Grants. The revised estimate is that this would cost approximately $3.6 million for the biennium and covers 500 new recipients. This fill-in grant would range from $100 to $6,195 for the year. The proposal does continue to amend the state grant award calculation to discontinue the subtraction of unawarded Pell Grants for the specified groups, those without a high school diploma and those not meeting the citizenship criteria under federal law. In addition, we also keep the communications campaign, which will help inform students, working adults, and families about expected college costs. And this was approximately $750,000 to the biennium, $500,000 in the first year, and $250,000 ongoing. In addition,
Could you just slow down your rate of speech? That would be helpful for me. Thank
Certainly,
you.
Madam Chair. The final component of the policy is to administer a pilot program for including child care expenses as a component of the state grant. As we mentioned previously, the current post-secondary child care grant is underutilized, and part of that is it has a complicated award formula. So we'd like to pilot a program that would simplify the award formula by bringing in child care expenses as a supplement in the state grant program. We have updated the bar charts to also show you what the revised proposal looks like in terms of Pell Grants, state grants, as well as the changes under both the LME and the AFR request. As you can see, we do maintain coverage of 100% of tuition fees up to $45,000 adjusted gross income at Minnesota State Colleges for dependent students. At Minnesota State Universities, we do maintain coverage up to $40,000 in adjusted gross income. Students at the $45,000 were covered under the original recommendation. However, under the revised recommendation, we're about $299 short for covering that group. And finally, as mentioned, given the tuition at the University of Minnesota, we do not cover 100% of tuition fees for that group. In terms of the impacts of the revised proposal for the state grant program, the governor continues to recommend reinvesting that available spending within the program, so the $20 million that is projected to be unspent within current general fund appropriations, to maintain the living and miscellaneous expense allowance. OHE increased the living and miscellaneous expense allowance this year to spend out unspent funds in fiscal year 19. However, should those funds not be reinvested, lower income students may see their grant decline next year without maintaining the LME. The available spending within the state grant program is the result of continued enrollment declines since the end of the recession, as well as increases to family income. And just for comparison purposes, current undergraduate enrollment is at its lowest level since 2003. Furthermore, the proposal builds on the prior work of the legislature by continuing to reduce the assigned family responsibility. This is an incremental change, increasing state grant awards. But by increasing state grant awards faster than tuition, we make strides in improving affordability by building up that purchasing power of the grant program. In addition, the governor's recommendation overall ensures that changes in the state grant awards offset any possible tuition increases at the Minnesota state system, ensuring that no current state grant recipient will see a net increase in costs because the state grant recommended changes exceed the 2% assumed tuition increase next year and the following year.
Representative Rumbeck.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to ask Ms. Furkus, and maybe you've in your previous presentations it's in there, but that do you show how the state grant program is spent? I mean, where these students are going to school that's available? And can you just say something about that, Ms. Fergus?
Madam Chair and Representative, I believe it's actually in the back of your slides. It is on page 11, slide 22. There's a table. I believe it's included in the handout. So what we have in this table on the left side are the base numbers. So you can see under the state grant award formula in law for next year, the number of recipients, for example, 44% of recipients are expected to be at Minnesota State, and they will receive $30.45 million under the base award. After the governor's budget, we maintain 44% of recipients, and the dollars to MinState increase by $9.64 million in the first year of the biennium, which is 19% of funding. Just a note on this table, the state grant award formula does recognize different tuitions, so two-year students are funded at a lower level than four-year students. So the number of recipients and the percent of dollars aren't going to align when you combine 2 years and 4 years together. So if you'd like to see this chart broken out by two-year and four-year, you'll see that the percent of recipients and the percentage of dollars are comparable once tuition differences are taken into account.
Thank you. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. slide 4, page 2, the second to the bottom bullet, coverage of child care expenses as a supplement to the state grant. Is that it take precedence over CCAP? Is it compatible with CCAP? How is that interaction?
Ms. Fergus.
Madam Chair, Representative. So students cannot double dip. So if a student is eligible for CCAP, they are not eligible for the post-secondary child care grant or this supplement through the Office of Higher Education. It's only those who are not eligible for CCAP that have access to this program.
Yep. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And what is the approximate, benefit that this tends to be?
Fergus.
Madam Chair, members, are you mean in terms of the average dollars per recipient? Okay. I am going to ask Ms. Grimes if she has that with her. I did not bring that table with me.
Ms. Grimes, welcome to the committee. If you could state your name and affiliation, that would be great.
Madam Chair, Tricia Grimes from the Office of Higher Education. Representative Quam, I will double check, but I believe the average amount received is about $2,800 per recipient.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so is that just during the term? In other words, child care would be paid out of this when the student is attending? Just clarifications.
Ms. Fergus.
Madam Chair, Representative Quam, yes, the student must be enrolled in college, so it would only cover those it's a term-based award, so for each semester or quarter the student is enrolled, they can be awarded a child care grant, yes. They must also actually submit documentation on the expenses incurred, as well as meet certain income criteria that are outlined in state law.
Yeah. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So this is a direct payment to the student or to the provider?
Ms. Fergus.
Madam Chair, Representative Quam, it is actually a direct,
Madam Chair, I believe it is included in the student's financial aid award, so the money first goes to the institution, and once all their tuition and fees are paid, then any overage can go to the student. But the student does have to provide documentation that they actually paid that amount to the child care provider. Mm-hmm.
Ms. Fergus.
Madam Chair and Representative Quam, I would add that actually the provider has to sign a form verifying they were paid as well.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And then on the next page, slide 6 indicates that a independent student with children, the proposed modifier is still 36% greater than without children, and I'm just curious as to the validity of that calculation.
Sure. Madam Chair, Representative Holmes. So the federal needs analysis calculation works a lot like tax code. And independent students with children are subject to a number of exemptions that independent students without children are not. So the net result of that calculation is that independent students with children are asked to contribute approximately 5% of their adjusted gross income towards college costs, whereas independent students without children are asked to contribute 33% of their adjusted gross income. So the Minnesota modifiers that are shown on this slide actually reflect those differences in overall percentage of adjusted gross income, and that's why the modifier is greater for independent students without children. But the net result is that independent students with children, it goes down to about 4% of adjusted gross income when the Minnesota calculation, and independent students without children, it remains about 12 to 15% of adjusted gross income. So net-wise, without the students without children still pay a higher percentage of income, even after this calculation.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, you may proceed. And can you just reiterate what page we're on and what slide number?
Madam Chair, we're on slide number 12. So that'd be page 6, bottom of page 6. So, Madam Chair, members, the governor maintains a investment in the Minnesota Reconnect program. We know that currently 10% of Minnesotans, representing about 138,000 individuals aged 25 to 44, have enrolled in college but have dropped out without completing. This program helps adult learners re-enroll and complete their post-secondary education. It recommends dedicated advising or requires dedicated advising, additional financial assistance, and improved campus services. The original governor's recommendation for this program was $8 million. The governor recommends investing $4 million in new funds for the biennium, which will serve approximately 500 students, and this program's focused solely on Minnesota State two-year colleges. The program started as a pilot program through the Lumina Foundation at four campuses. And this program targets colleges who demonstrate a commitment to adult learners and re-enrolling adult learners and helping them to complete. So this investment maintains those program investments by the Lumina Foundation. The four colleges participating for information is Riverland Community College, South Central College, Inver Hills Community College, and Lake Superior College. And there are currently 174 participants in the program. The next program the governor maintains investment in is the Intervention for College Attendance Program, or ICAP. These are grants to programs that foster academic success and ensure underrepresented students are prepared for college and career. Governor recommends investing $336,000 for the biennium, which is a 25% increase in the current appropriation, the first increase in funding in this program recommended by the governor since 2008. This reaches more students and targeted specific high-need student populations, and grant recipients include nonprofits, post-secondary institutions, independent school districts, and professional associations. And then the Summer Academic Enrichment Program is also a maintained investment by the governor through the recommendation. We know that summer vacation takes a toll on students' knowledge and skills. We know that students from low-income families, according to the research, are especially vulnerable to summer melt and find it difficult to catch up the following year. So the governor recommends an additional $250,000 increase for the biennium for the Summer Academic Enrichment Program, and scholarship students average about $878. With the investment, up to 250 additional elementary and secondary students will receive scholarships to attend approved summer academic programs. Take slides.
Slide 16 represents the governor's continued recommendation to expand the statewide longitudinal education data system and to provide sustained state funding for the early childhood longitudinal data system. The recommendation stays at $2 million for the biennium. These systems are used to measure outcomes for Minnesota students as well as the performance of state-funded programs. It allows the data that's produced allows policymakers, educators, and parents to make informed decisions and to identify barriers to education and employment. Specifically for the early childhood system, these dollars are replacing expiring federal funds, and without replacement, the early childhood system would cease to operate.
Okay, and then Ms. Fergus, so the SLEDS part, that's for the statewide longitudinal education data system. What is that? Is it $2 million for expansion or just to maintain it?
Madam Chair, the $2 million represents both recommendations. So of that $2 million, $1.7 million is for the early childhood system, and approximately $300,000 is for the SLED system. The $300,000 is to add an additional IT staff person as a business analyst, as well as to purchase some new data so that we can kind of keep up with demand.
And Ms. Fergus, when does this information, does it get just collected for years and then reported, or is there information that we are receiving that I should be watching for, or could you please share that with us?
Madam Chair, that's a great question. So the SLEDS actually maintains a public website where you can actually go and by year of high school graduation as well as by school, you can actually look to see how many high school graduates are enrolling in college, what their academic profile is, and how many of them actually are staying in college and persisting. In addition, on the DEED website, you can follow college graduates into the workforce, and this is some of the underlying data that's also used for WIOA reporting to the feds. And you can actually track for students who graduate, for example, with a bachelor's degree in history from the University of Minnesota Twin Cities, what industries are they working in, what areas of the state, and what is their wages at years 2, 3, 4, and 5. We're hoping to expand the time frame, of course, out to years 8 and 10 as well. But this allows you to understand how many of those graduates are working and what their employment outcomes are in terms of wages as well as opportunities. In addition, we provide actual data back to school districts that they can use in their World's Best Workforce reporting, both in terms of college going and college completion. But we've also added data that allows them to know how many high school graduates are moving directly into work and kind of what industries those students are working in if they do move immediately from high school into work. We also provide data back to the colleges so they can understand their employment data at the program level. So should they need to understand how many graduates from a given program are finding sustained employment, they can use that as a measure of evaluation in determining academic programming ongoing. We also invest in a number of research projects. So, for example, we study the outcomes of students who are in developmental education and how many of them, what areas of developmental education they need assistance in and what their outcomes are compared to similar students who do not need developmental education. We've also studied the impact of dual credit. We know that students involved in the variety of forms of dual credit enroll in college at higher rates and complete college and higher rates in Minnesota. There's a number, we just also, you will see a press release in the coming days. We did just finish a study that examined the post-secondary outcomes for students identified as homeless in K-12. So for those students who received the McKinney-Vento homeless flag, we studied the percent of students who make it to high school graduation, how many go on to college, and how many have completed college if they were enrolled in high school in grades 2005 through 2011. That study is a little bit of a downer, because there are approximately 2,000 ninth graders who are identified as homeless in high school, and the study found that less than 10% of them actually finished college within a decade. So,
yeah. Okay, I'm glad I asked. Thank you. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And noticing on slide 15 that about 12.2% overhead, you're adding $250K. The average scholarship is 878, so that 12.2% goes where?
Oh, Ms. Fergus.
Madam Chair, Representative Clark.
I think so, no.
100% of these dollars actually go to students. There's no administrative funds for this program that are included in that cost.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Then the up to 250 actually would be larger than that, it'd be about 277 students. I was just wondering why that, you know, the math didn't work out on that.
Madam Chair, Representative Kwan, the 878 is what we actually paid out last year. In determining the 250, we did assume that costs will likely increase a little bit and those grant amounts will go up for next year. And so it's a little bit of a kind of a price increase.
Thank you. Madam Chair, on 216, the slide that you were just discussing, in the data, you know, it's interesting data. Does it ever get fed back to the school districts, the proportionality, and what remedial courses their students are taking so they can look at how they can actually improve delivery of skills and capabilities?
Ms. Fergus.
Madam Chair, Representative Kwong, yes. The school districts can actually get the information in a couple of ways. We are in the process of creating a new website that will allow an interactive drop-down with detailed level data at the school district. We do provide a summary report on developmental education on the sleds.mn.gov website. But school districts that apply can actually get access to a de-identified file of student-level data that allows them to look at various characteristics of individuals and see what kind of credits they're taking in each of the four developmental education subject areas. So the school district can know if the student is taking developmental education, math, reading, writing, or other at the post-secondary level. So they can do a little more refined analysis on their side.
Yep. Thank you. And Madam Chair, you've got the data for wage and placement. Is that being utilized by the campuses for deciding what programs they need to maybe increase or decrease, and do they feed that back to the students and the families? Because, you know, frankly, if you discover some of the majors, the placement is really horrible, and they, you know, that should somehow be communicated back. Mm-hmm. And also, if there's a high demand, you know, that could be communicated, because, you know, that kind of information may be quite useful for the students so they don't have huge debt and no capability of paying it back. So is there something that's ongoing, and what's the visibility beyond the colleges but also out to the public?
Ms. Fergus.
Madam Chair, Representative, yes. We do feed the data back to the colleges in a similar de-identified student-level file so they can do their academic program reviews. We don't typically see the results of those. They tend to be internal and not necessarily shared with our office. However, we do make the data available publicly on the DEED website, and we know that it's actually used at workforce centers as well as career services offices on campus. So we do encourage that utilization. There is one caveat, though. We actually can't measure placement. So we know what the student is getting their credential in, be it a certificate or a degree, in history, philosophy, you know, welding. We do not necessarily know what occupation they are in. Current Minnesota unemployment insurance requirements do not require businesses to report the occupation of the worker, only information about the business. So we know their industry, we know their size and location, as well as the total wages paid and total hours worked. So we can't quite get to placement, but we can approximate it in terms of what the hourly wage of the individual is, as well as what industry they're working in. Yeah.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And because when we were talking with the U of M, you know, one of the interesting points was the U of M Rochester is 100% placement. Now that means either they're accepted in a higher degree program or working. But this kind of information, I think, has many uses. I just maybe in a larger scale, like the state as a whole, or, you know, by types of schools, it'd be nice to have that available for students, because guidance counselors probably have some visibility to it, but we've got a lot of people that work for a year or two, and now they're going to school, you know, the non-traditional. And, you know, that type of information and easy access, I think, would be very useful, especially for, you know, matching skills and intent to the workforce needs that are present would be evident. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. This information sounds very helpful. And has there been, Ms. Grimes and Ms. Fergus, you know, your new Commissioner Olson, so you might not be able to answer this, but I didn't have to, like, call that out. I don't know why I did. But I just want to know, when was the last time, like, this was presented to a higher education body to explain how to get the data, what it looks like, kind of a primer?
Madam Chair, that is a great question. I actually don't think we've presented to a legislative committee in 4 years.
We did provide brochures the last time. Both systems are actually governed by the P20 Education Partnership, which does include legislative members as members of that body. That partnership can actually make requests for reports, as well as you can make requests to the individual commissioners as well. We have enough flexibility that should a report be needed, we can produce it within, we ask that you give us like a few months, because all requests have to go through a vetting process to produce them overnight. But with 6 months lead time, we can easily produce any report, provided the data is available. Yeah.
And then I want to, Representative Kwan wants to follow up, but I do have a question to follow up on that. So is the data accessible without requesting a report in a few months in advance? Is it user-friendly for someone like on this committee?
Absolutely, Madam Chair. On the sleds.mn.gov website, there are a number of frequently asked questions that we have, and we've developed indicators to report on those. And then you can actually choose what kind of geography you want to look at, whether it's statewide counts, economic development region, school district, or individual school level data. Mm-hmm. Yep. I do know that for one of the critical questions we're working on now is about student mobility. So how many students graduate from an individual high school? Where do they go to college? Are they leaving their community? But ultimately, 5-10 years down the line, are they coming back? And this is a question that really came out of the Marshall area. They wanted to know how many high school graduates they were losing, either to South Dakota or colleges outside of their local area, and wanted to know how many of those students were making their way back for work. And so that is actually something we're going to be producing at the local level for all of Minnesota.
Okay, thank you. Representative Crom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And along the lines that you were interested in, the K-12 database is very large, extensive, with many variables, and it can be a difficult thing to navigate. But I'm thinking this sounds a little bit more palatable to the average legislator. So if there's a crib sheet, introductory type thing that would be passed on to the committee, then we could, look at, and then through playing and experiencing, we'd have a better feel, and it might assist us in our future endeavors of making best choices for the state of Minnesota and our citizens.
Great. Okay, thank you. Ms. Burgess.
Madam Chair and members, you might remember that when we presented the governor's national recognition, we did include a cheat sheet for you. And so it does provide some of the frequently asked questions and the data that's available on the website, but we're happy to provide additional technical assistance in using the data. But and again, as I mentioned before, we're actually looking to be more responsive to legislative needs and stakeholder needs. So any questions that you might have that's not currently available on the website, we'd really appreciate you telling us so we could add them. Yeah.
Madam Chair, possibly a soft copy would be easiest to utilize.
What is a soft copy?
An attachment to an email.
Oh, gotcha. Okay, I never heard that before. Sorry. Taught me something new today, Representative Quam. Okay.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Ms. Ferguson.
Commissioner Olson did ask me to clarify that in terms of inquiries, new questions require a longer time frame because we have to get them approved by our essentially research and governance committee. If they are existing questions that we already have authority to analyze, such as developmental education or college going or employment after college patterns, those we can respond to in a much faster turnaround.
Yep. Okay. And then does the data drill down into people's ethnicity and geography and those sorts of things? Zip code?
Madam Chair, we do not go down to the zip code level. We do include the basic special populations that you would see in most K-12 reporting, so free and reduced price lunch, special education, limited English proficient, race, ethnicity, and gender. Yep. Okay. And we do a similar reporting on the post-secondary side, so new students as well as college completers and employment after college. We have populations of free and reduced price lunch. Nope, not free and reduced. Gender, race, ethnicity, and Minnesota residency status.
Okay, and so now we're a little over halfway through our presentation with you, and I haven't looked to how much we have to go. How are we doing for time?
Madam Chair, I think we have actually four slides left, four or five slides, and I know you have another bill on the agenda here, so we'll move quickly through.
And, yeah, we may have member questions after as well. So no rush. We're doing fine. So are we on page 17 now? Is that where we're starting?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Not page 17, page 9, slide 17.
Correct.
On the hard copy.
So, Madam Chair, on behalf of the University of Minnesota, the governor is recommending continuing to support education, research, and outreach at all five of the University of Minnesota system campuses. The governor is recommending a $51.034 million increase for the core services for the biennium, and again, that represents a 3.9 increase in the base. The governor is also still committed to the capital investment, including $28 million for the child development building on the Twin Cities campus, $4.3 million for the renovation of the A.B. Anderson Hall at UMD, and the $117.7 million for HEPR request. On behalf of Minnesota State, the governor's investment is, of course, focused on supporting high-quality, affordable education at the seven state universities and 30 community and technical colleges in the MinState system. The governor is now recommending $64.798 million increase for the biennium, again representing a 4.5 increase over the base. The governor maintains the $8 million down payment for the ISRS Next Generation system need, as well as $56.798 million for the biennium for campus support. We know the ISRS Next Generation system supports the finance, accounting, and human resource software needs of the system, as well as student systems for applications, registration schedules, financial aid, transcripts, and more. The governor also still continues to maintain the support for 100% of MinState's HEPR requests at $150 million.
And can I just ask you a question regarding the ISRS Next Generation funding? It's a down payment. So do you have any projection on how the payment would be handled in the future to cover the cost, not cover the cost? Do you have any, like, forward planning on that?
Madam Chair, the governor has continued to indicate that this is a down payment on the actual need, recognizing that the ask and the full need is much higher. I believe information from the system had a little over a $17 million need in the first year. And so our understanding is that those costs would either be absorbed by the system or unfortunately have to be passed along to the campuses. But the governor has made a commitment to continuing to invest in the system until the system is fully up to speed.
Okay. Go ahead. So what's the next? The next slide is number 8. No, you got it. That's right. We're in the end. So what we're going to do now is ask for the next, like, 15 minutes or so, maybe 20, ask members if they have any questions, and then also ask if there's anyone in the public here who would like to testify regarding this budget. Representative Lilly.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Commissioner, and thank you for going through the budget. It's very informative and good. I was just wondering if you've had opportunities to listen to kind of our hearings, and I know the Senate's going to, but I'm sure staff has been at, I know they've been at many, but I'm sure you've had an opportunity to see some of our hearings. Some of them have been kind of compelling, and there's some other bills that might not quite have made it in your budget that kind of appealed to me, and they're smaller items. And we heard some great testimony. It's not my bill, but it's on the food dependence, the food needs of students, and it just really makes a lot of sense that we do something in that area. Somehow it'd be nice if that could get to you and signed by the governor, because I could talk about it quite a long time, but it that just made a lot of sense, and I don't know how kids can really study and be, if they're not housed and adequately fed and that sort of thing. So hopefully as we come along, I hope it's maybe part of our bill and can get to you. Sorry, we're kind of bobbing and weaving here. So hopefully you look at that, and then I guess I had another area. I can't find it in my head right now, but thank you. We'll get to that. I'll ask a question later maybe.
Representative Lilly, was it? Forever Green? No, we did not hear that in the committee. I'm doing Representative Cleaver's job.
That'd be very
right
nice
now.
If Forever Green was in here.
But that I think was Representative Poppy's bill in here.
Okay, we can lobby for that one.
Right, okay.
Thank you.
Well, if you think of it, Representative Lilly, you just let me know.
Thank you.
Is it any other, are there any other members or people from the audience? Commissioner Olson, and then we'll go to Representative Nornes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to respond to Representative Lilly's inquiry, thank you very much for highlighting that. And I've certainly been keeping close tabs on the additional hearings, both as part of the governor's recommendations and those that are coming from elsewhere. And that one in particular regarding food insecurity is certainly near and dear to my heart. And what I appreciate most about that bill is that it's been a student-led initiative. And I think that's the most impactful. I certainly don't want to speak for any of the members on the committee here, but you know, hearing from students is really where some of the best things come from, and certainly they're expressing their needs and their real true experience today in school. And you know, I will just say, sitting with my colleagues, other commissioners on the Interagency Council to Prevent and End Homelessness, you know, I made sure to highlight the students that are experiencing homelessness and experiencing food insecurity on our campuses. And you know, I know deeply that that's an issue, and it's not a new issue, but it's certainly a ballooning issue and something we want to keep close eyes on. And so I know Ms. Grimes had testified when that bill came up, and certainly we'll do all we can, whether it's providing a seal, working with campuses to ensure that, you know, they're administering their grants appropriately or doing what we can, we'll be there. So I appreciate that, Representative Lilly.
Okay, Representative Nornes, you might want to jot your idea down, because Representative Lilly's got his thought back in mind. So I want to make sure I don't hold him up. Okay. So perfect. Go ahead, Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm sorry, Representative Nornes. It did come back to me. It's a little embarrassing because this is actually my bill. But it's it was just it was brought to me, and it wasn't. But it was with people, you know, educating teachers. You know, that can teach our kids, or to, you know, so having more teachers that can serve the people that are blind or and handicapped in that area. So hopefully you can consider that too. It's not a big ask, but hopefully that fits in somewhere, because it makes a lot of sense that we help people, and it really would be life-changing for those particular people. So anyways, thank you.
Representative Nornes.
Madam Chair. I've been somewhat interested in an article I saw involving Purdue University, where they haven't had a tuition increase since 2012, and through this year it'll be held flat. Have you had any feedback from either of the two systems, Minnesota State or the university, as to, based on the budget now the governor is proposing, what that might do to local tuition in Minnesota?
Commissioner Olson?
Yep. Madam Chair and Representative Nornes, and I'm looking to Meredith to see if she has any information specific to Purdue. The governor heard loud and clear from campus leaders, from students, from faculty, about the needs to invest in our systems, both the University of Minnesota and MinState, and invest in them strongly. And so the governor was able to secure additional dollars for further investments in those systems. And you know, we understand that it only maybe gets us part of the way, and you know, we're hoping, and the governor's hopeful that to be able to keep tuition increases at a minimum and still invest in students through the state grant is something we now can be proud of through the revised budget. But we've heard loud and clear, I certainly have, as well as the governor, from our leaders, and we appreciate that. Like I had mentioned to Representative Lilly, when those students bring their concerns right to you, that has a huge impact, and we react to that.
Okay, thank you, Representative Fryer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm just looking at going back to slide 16, if we can. I wanted to run, if you would run by those numbers again. The request is for $2 million. In the budget, and that it's picking up where the federal funding has dropped off, or is it also increasing funding to a need?
Madam Chair and Representative Furr, so the $2 million is split, $1.7 million to the early childhood system and $300,000 to the SLED system. The early childhood system was built under a 2012 federal grant and then continued to fund under a 2015 U.S. Department of Ed grant. In addition, the Office of Higher Education transferred approximately $300,000 in funding in the current biennium to maintain IT infrastructure for that program from the SLED system over. We're not going to be able to maintain that transfer going forward because we, too, are finding ourselves under increasing IT costs, of course. And so does that kind of answer your question?
Right. And so where does the early childhood data system live?
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, Representative, the early child live is always a funny question.
Yeah.
So all data is at a state data center, which is run by Minute. The system itself is governed by the Department of Education, Department of Health, and Department of Human Services, and they make joint decisions about administration, governance, and however, on the funding side, OHE has gotten involved, and so because we help them maintain funding in the current biennium, we're now talking about a combined infrastructure to increase efficiency. So it would be health, human services, higher education, and then we also have Department of Corrections is actually a member of SLEDS now, and so that would be the fifth state agency.
Okay,
yep.
Thank you. And thank you, Madam Chair.
Yeah,
I do remember
Mr. Fryer.
Remember some of this discussion from last session too. And then if one more question, just briefly, we talked about even tracking data. Is homelessness something that we track for the higher ed students that are homeless?
Ms. Burgess.
Madam Chair, Representative. So there is a flag on the FAFSA data that indicates whether the student has been granted independent student status based on a homelessness status. That incident of homelessness could have occurred in K-12 or in higher education.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not necessarily representative as currently experiencing homelessness, more as ever experienced homelessness.
Mm-hmm.
Other than that, there is no consistent tracking of students' housing status at any of our colleges. And that's actually something we probably need to work on, because if you can't identify who is experiencing homelessness, you certainly can't serve them well. And so that's something we're actually planning to work on as part of our work with the Interagency Council to End and Prevent Homelessness.
Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yes, thank you. And I would like to recognize, I see a former representative out in the audience, Representative Rosenthal. Welcome to our committee today. And we do have a regent with us, I see. Dr. Omari is here today. So thank you for being here. We have Representative Cleavorn.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. I just want to make sure that I look at this last one of the last pages. On page 11, on slide 22, I just want to make sure that I'm reading this properly. So as I'm reading it, the Minnesota four-year universities are receiving 42.3% of the state grant money in your formula. The University of Minnesota is getting $69.7 million in the state grant. And then the nonprofit institutions will be receiving an estimated $77.3 million. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Representative Cleaver, no.
Okay,
so for example,
yeah.
If you look at the for-profit line, the 5.13 includes the $1 million that was increased.
It doesn't, okay,
it does.
So it's not an additional, that 70.51 is including the $6.86 million.
Okay, so just hold up here a second. Could you, when you say these numbers, could you say what column?
Oh, excuse me.
What column
okay.
you're in? So column 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6.
So on page, on slide 22,
yep.
If you go to the very last column,
yep.
And it will say, and that's what I wanted to make sure I understood. So it'll say Minnesota State Grants in millions, and there was a 36. So Minnesota four-year universities says $36.77 million.
Mm-hmm.
I was trying to determine whether the plus 5.65 was included in that $36.77 million or not.
Mm-hmm.
So the initial number that I gave of 42.3, I had added it in.
Got
so
it.
I thought it was an increase to that number.
Right.
And that's what I was asking for clarification on, just wanting to make sure that I'm reading the chart in the appropriate manner.
So it is not an increase to that number. It was the increase made, but the number is 36.77.
Correct,
Madam
right.
Chair.
So I still have a concern, Madam Chair, that the
Representative Cleavorn.
that the Minnesota private institutions are receiving $70.51 million, while the University of Minnesota system is getting $63.67 million, and our four-year universities are receiving $36.77 million. And that's just a statement that I have concern about that.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think it's sort of self-evident if you take the pie chart and make convert it to numbers, it just happens to be the percentage of students receiving those types of grants, what it works out to. It's not saying we're limiting. It's more of this is the result as opposed to the other one. Back to you had queried about homelessness.
Representative Quam, I just want to say I didn't really follow you on that, and I'll just let Representative Cleburne like say how she sees it or something, and then you can would you like to say again how you see it yourself?
I understood what he was saying.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, no, I totally understood what he was saying, and it is a matter of a math equation. I totally get that. I can do that math myself. The concern that I have is that public dollars are going to fund. When we are at a time of needing more and more of our dollars to go to our public institutions, that more of these dollars are flowing out to private and for-profit institutions. I'm merely saying that I would like to see those dollars serve our students inside of our public system. But I totally understand how the math works. Thank you, Representative Quam.
Okay, yeah. Representative Quam.
Thank you. And it's a function of, you know, the kids choose where they want to go. As a parent, I realize that's not always what I think they ought to do. But going back to the query by the chair as to homelessness and et cetera, I believe, and I'm not sure if it was a pilot, but at one time for some portion of the population, when they fill out this rather large thing, if they want student financial aid, in there is information that would be able to, and with a regular periodicity, have the data of if they're homeless, you know, and what are their living conditions. So that is probably controlled by the federal government, and I'm not sure if we have accessibility, but if there was a desire, we probably could get some sort of a generalized ballpark of that data. But it might be a request through the department and to the feds, or it might be something the department already has accessibility for generic, you know, information.
Madam Chair?
Ms. Fergus?
Yes. So our office does receive a copy of every Minnesota resident who files the FAFSA, as well as any non-resident attending a Minnesota college. So we could query the FAFSA database and actually summarize how many students have that homelessness exemption flag on their FAFSA. The only caveat is that, again, it could be homelessness at any time. It's not necessarily homelessness in the current year. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you. Yeah, Ms. Representative Cleveland.
I just want to have one other comment, and I would like to just thank the commissioner for the time that the commissioner spent with me in working through some concerns that I have, and I would like to say that I appreciate the commissioner's concern for our students who are most in need, and to see that our graduation rates improve and that more and more students are included in our educational system. I'd like to just say thank you for that commitment to our students. Thank you.
Thank you. With no one else on the list, I want to thank you for coming to our committee today and giving us this update. We appreciate it very much and look forward to ending session with a wonderful bill for our students and people attaining their degrees and helping our state.
Madam Chair, members, thanks for the opportunity once again to come and ditto.
Yeah, yeah. Thank you.
I agree.
Okay, thank you very much. Okay, so would someone like to move the minutes for March 20th, 2019?
So moved, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Vang. She has made a motion to approve the minutes for March 20th, 2019. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. The motion prevails, and the minutes for March 20, 2019 are approved. Our next bill up is Representative Claflin. I wasn't getting the first L in there. Claflin's bill. Welcome to our committee. And do you have anyone testifying with you today at all?
No, I don't.
Okay, thank you. Thank you for being here. And if you could explain your bill, and I'll move your bill for House File 603 to be referred to Ways and Means.
Thank you. Excuse me. I brought House File 603 to you today, requesting the University of Minnesota to do a study. They would review some research that would relate to the exposure of per- and polyfluoroalkyl substances. I'm going to try to keep the chemistry to a minimum, but these are some chemicals that are very pervasive in our environment. They're used in everything from Teflon and stain repellents to the coating inside of some of our food containers. They are incredibly stable in our environment. They don't break down. And they are found in the blood of just about everyone. There is some concern about the safety of these chemicals. The Minnesota Department of Health does have some health-based values that set some guidance for what the acceptable levels of these chemicals are. But just to give you an idea of what some of the risks are, in some of the studies, higher levels of PFAS, that's the acronym for these per- and polyfluorinated alkyl substances, higher levels in a person's body are associated with higher cholesterol, changes in liver function, reduced immune response, thyroid disease, and increased kidney and testicular cancer. And there really does need to be a lot more work done to determine if there are any other health outcomes. Experimental studies have shown that these chemicals can cause cancer. Looking at the epidemiology, we can't say that it caused any particular cancer, but we can associate the incidence of cancer with the presence of these chemicals. I do want to reinforce that the water is safe to drink. Our public water supply is treated. People that are on private wells have the option to have treated water or get water from other sources. But we do need to know more about these chemicals and what effect they have on our health. They are found throughout the country. This is not just in the East Metro area where we have the contamination from the 3M manufacturing facilities. These are around the country and honestly around the world. My sister lives in Australia and they're dealing with exactly the same problem there. They are found in firefighting foams. So around airports, there's often contaminated wells. Around firefighting training areas, there's often contaminated water as well. We'll hear those bills later tonight.
And Representative Claflin, so we're just, and members, I want to let you know that we're going to be listening to the port, just discussing the portion that has to do with higher ed.
Yes.
So can you lead us into the part in which higher ed is involved in this bill?
Yes. There are six parts to the study that we're requesting the university produce. They would produce this report in January of 2020. And the first step would be an in-depth review of the health studies and health assessments that the Department of Health used when they created their health-based recommendations. This is that health-based guidance that I mentioned. The second piece is an in-depth review of the methodology and data sources and the conclusions that they drew from those. I'm a scientist, and we like peer-reviewed science. So the more review, a second set of eyes is always desired. The third piece would be listening sessions around the state with community members, other stakeholders, really to understand concerns, the public's perception of risk, and understanding what the public health information has been. The fourth piece is identification of other analysis that could be done with the existing data that would give us a better understanding of what the exposure risks really are to the community members in the East Metro and around the state. The fifth piece is to review evidence for other populations. We know that these chemicals are present in surface water and groundwater throughout the state, and there are almost certainly other populations that are affected. And the sixth and final piece of the report would be to identify other research that could be done to build on this knowledge that we've already created. And they should be able to give us some preliminary protocols and cost estimates for a few priorities for further research. And the request is for $315,000 in fiscal year 2020 from the general fund.
Thank you. And Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A couple questions here for the bill author. The first is, you just referenced the $315,000 appropriation that you're proposing. How did you arrive at that number?
Representative Claflin.
The amount came from discussion with the University of Minnesota and what it would take to produce a study like this.
Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And then the next question is, as you just described, and as I want to make sure I heard you correctly, as I'm reading this, the different numbers, it looks like the gist of this is to review, and as you mentioned, peer review, the work that had already been performed by the Department of Health. And is there anything new that's going to be happening as a result of this proposal, with the exception of, I see item number 3 on lines 1.17 and 1.18, is there anything new that's going to be produced, or is it the vast majority just simply reviewing work already performed?
Representative Claflin.
There would actually be quite a bit of new work produced. The third part of the report, the listening sessions, would be new information. The fourth part, identifying other analysis that could be done with the existing data, reviewing the other populations in Minnesota that may be exposed, and prioritizing other research. Those would all be new components in a report that would go beyond just a peer review.
One more question, Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And either to the chair or to the bill author, do you know what the path of this bill is? And specifically, does the path of this involve the judiciary in terms of review of data?
Where I know so far that it's going to is Ways and Means, and the pathway that I am aware of is Health and Human Services.
Okay, then, Madam Chair, with that follow-up, would the bill author know when I'm looking at item number 1 on lines 1.1, beginning on line 1.12, so review of the health studies and health assessments, I'm not familiar with what that might involve. Does that involve data from individuals that would then become available and to the people performing this study, or is that data that's not personally identifiable information at all?
Representative Claflin.
I am not sure, Chair and Representative Lucero, if there is identifiable data within that or what level of disaggregation that would include. That may be a question for the Department of Health. When it goes to Health and Human Services, I'm sure we'll discuss it.
So I would just add that, Madam Chair, if it does involve that type of data for the bill author, potential path for judiciary so we can examine what types of data might be made available.
Representative Nornes.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and the author. I'm kind of curious. I'm not sure what the ultimate goal is here after this study has been done. It seems that this product is in a lot of different places, and I'm just kind of curious what would happen if that product wasn't in those places. Would we, you know, I'm not sure if we did away with it, if that's the intent, what would happen? It seems it's there for a purpose, and I don't understand, I guess, what it is.
Representative Claflin.
Chemicals are certainly used for a purpose. I think we know a lot more about the chemistry of this particular one. It may not be so necessary in our microwave popcorn bags as it is in some other applications. We may learn that there's other safer substitutes available. I don't think that this is geared at looking at what phasing out any of the chemicals would be, just the risk of exposure.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And looking at this, research is in the more or less the title of the Section 1, but what I see repetitive is review. If there had been something about analyzing, because I know Prop 65, there's been a lot of utilization. I think Europe with their REACH program has some more data. We're reviewing, I'm assuming it's the Minnesota Department of Health, and they're not reviewing national and international research.
Representative Claflin.
Chair and Representative Quam, I'm not entirely sure what your question was regarding international research. I know that the Department of Health does rely on solid peer-reviewed science, and while a lot of this language uses the word review, I am a research scientist, and a lot of my job is reviewing data.
Representative Quam has a follow-up.
Most certainly. Frankly, if you're familiar with Prop 65, there's been California's done a lot of activity with Silicon Valley and a lot of the chemical development and other issues. They probably have at least two orders of magnitude worse than Minnesota's facing. So I do know that there's quite a bit of actual research that was done out there. Being familiar with Europe and the European community, I'm familiar with their research and when they went into REACH and some other looks at regulatory activity. They were not just limiting to, in this state, it's an issue. They wanted to find out all the states that this might be in, and that if it's in a fire, it gets released. They did quite a bit of a broader research, testing, data collection, and et cetera. And I was, when I first saw this, I thought first thing that came to mind was we were maybe assisting the U of M in researching alternative, chemicals or products that might be utilized. When you're talking about, airport, a plane's on fire, and the foam, I think their first priority is the safety, putting out that fire. You don't have, things blow up and more people killed. And usually when you're doing research, we don't like this. You don't just look at, our Department of Health, because there are possibly things that they didn't look at because we don't utilize it as sufficiently. Sometimes we're considered flyover country with some of the things other states and nations maybe have utilized certain variations of this product in different situations, so that if I was going to do fund a addition to the existing peer review, I would open it up to a broader possible sourcing so that we could have a more comprehensive. We have very good people, but there are a lot of people out there that are doing comparable things that might give us a more complete view if we're going to research, because you're looking at reviewing all these things, and then you do get down to identification of priorities for scientifically sound research. And if we don't look at the global international environment for research, then we may be copying something that else has done, or we may miss
you know, something that's out there that could help us do, you know, a better job. So, you know, my suggestion is maybe look at broadening out all the different areas and aspects that might contribute to a more global and thorough and effective review of, you know, what's out there now and what might be going on. I know there are some conferences that have been connected with, you know, some of these topics nationally, internationally, that would be, you know, maybe good sources of, you know, of reviewing those to be able to put into, you know, this bill. Because right now, you know, my big reluctance is I see a lot of review, which there should already be a peer review on all the things that you're reviewing. And then your listening sessions, which is good to hear from the public, but a lot of times one of the functions we have is to communicate and educate the public to what might be out there. You know, because
Representative Quam, I'm getting some coaching around me, and people, I'm getting coaching, like, could you ask your question or finish your comments?
Madam Chair, some of what we do here is we try to help the author make the bill into a better bill.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to give her, you know, the analysis of, I see some, you know, lacking.
Right, yeah.
And to beef up the bill, you know, how could we improve it?
Right.
And that's what I'm trying to
have that conversation. I appreciate that. If you could wrap up your comments or ask a question. This is just a comment, so it was your suggestion. That's your
right. I did ask, and I took the nod and the expressions as to familiarity with the Prop 65, the reach, and some of the other things. But I will be available maybe for some discussions with the author offline to see how we could improve the attempt here.
Thank you. We have two more people on the list, Representative Pryor and then Representative Cleburne.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you for bringing this forward, because I know that, probably everybody in Minnesota has some concerns about these chemicals, especially since there seems to be a lot of things that we hear, but not a clear statement of what standards are out there and how they were created. And I appreciate the idea of the listening session to kind of gauge how people can understand risks and the best way to present risks. And I would like to know a little bit more, you know, obviously you know what you're doing. You know how these things work. So is the January 15th, 2020 would be sufficient time to produce a valuable report that would really, when it comes back to the proper committee and legislature, that they would have information that enough information to act on?
Representative Cleburne.
Oh,
that's my next question. I'm just ahead of myself. Representative Claflin.
That date was brought up by discussion with the University of Minnesota.
Mm-hmm.
If they think they need more time, I'm sure we can offer an amendment and make sure that it's enough time to actually give us a good report.
Thank you. Representative Pryor.
At this, I don't know if you know the answer, but how long ago was it that the Department of Health made the recommendation? And would there be new data that's out there since the department the Department of Health made the recommendation?
Representative Claflin.
I am not sure exactly when that discussion took place, but I'm sure it was with the knowledge of what our timeline is in the session.
Thank you.
Representative Cleburne, I was anxious to have you ask your question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I will take it as a compliment that you confused my name with Representative Claflin. But actually, Representative Pryor asked the question that I had, so I'm good. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Do you have any? Is there anyone in the public who would like to testify on this bill? Okay. Would you like to make some closing remarks?
Yes. Thank you, Chair. Thank you, members. I take your questions and your comments with. Gosh, now I can't think of it. I accept all of your comments. Thank you very much. And I'm looking forward to working with Representative Quam to make this an even better bill. There's certainly a lot of work that's being done on this issue around the country and around the world. We should absolutely rely on experts. That's sort of the scientific way to rely on our experts. And I do believe that this study would give us not only the knowledge of what these risks are, but what do people understand about the risks? What do people think about the safety of their drinking water before we help do anything to clean up the water? I encountered people that were showering with bottled water because they were so afraid of these chemicals, and that's certainly not necessary, but there's a lot of misinformation out there. Having a study from the university would help us have a neutral third party that's respected for their science. It help us inform the community about the real risks here and carry this information beyond just the borders of Minnesota. The university is respected throughout the country, throughout the world, for their work, and they may be able to be a resource to other research institutions, other states that are encountering the same problem. We know that there's other populations that are exposed to this, and having good information about the real risks and exposure would be incredibly helpful.
Thank you. With that, I renew my motion that and move that House File 603 be referred to Ways and Means. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? The motion passes. Thank you for coming to our committee and have a great day. Okay, so with that, just a second. Okay, never mind. Okay, the meeting is adjourned.